Really?
But such was the caliber of the people, the gunnery officer on down, that the next shoot we had was one of the best that the Australian squadron had ever had. And we see, when HRH left us, HMAS Australia took him home to England and did a refit and then took our place in the Australian. We took her place in the Australian squadron. We stayed on the Australian station for the ensuing year, which was great fun. And of course, it was an opportunity no Canadians ever had, never will have.
Yeah, right.
And vast interest. We visited all the state capitals on cruising around the coast at one time or another, and at various other places as well. And it was just superb. I must say, I've never been back again. I just love to go. We had, I think on our way down the Red Sea, when we had all these people on board, we had pressmen as well, of course. And I was ill-advised enough to let representative of the Melbourne Herald know that my great-great-uncle had been the first governor of Western Australia. In fact, he'd established the colony. And as we were going through the Indian Ocean, I was following Commander Creasy around. I was his doggy. He turned to me one day with the chief yeoman brought him a signal and said, "Sterling, can you lunch with the West Australian Historical Society on the 5th of October?" And taking an absolute step back, I said, "Well, yes, if you say so." So he turned to the chief yeoman and said, "Say yes." And this was the first I knew to the fact that this fellow had sent on ahead that in this royal ship was a descendant of the first governor of the state of Western Australia. And this was interesting from my family point of view, and the cuttings and the things I sent to my father and so on were great interest. Because they had asked my father to go out there in 29 for the centennial celebrations of the founding of the state to play the part of Captain James Sterling in their pageant. But he couldn't go. He didn't have enough money, and he didn't have the time either. And so it was of great interest to him that his son should get down there and see the situation and so on.
Very nice.
And most interesting for me. And also extremely embarrassing for me, because it was a toss-up on the day we arrived, which was the 4th of October, 3rd or 4th. It was a toss-up whether Henry Duke of Gloucester or M. Sterling had more front page space in the local press.
So your captain sort of frowned at that?
Oh, he took it dark as possible, you know. And even more, Captain Commander Creasy, who became Admiral of the Fleet eventually, he took the darkest still view, I think, really. Not the place of a junior midshipman.
Yeah.
Challenge a prince of the blood on his own ground. How the prince of the blood took it in good, pretty good heart. Didn't seem to mind very much. It made a different aspect of life for me.
Yeah, you had a bit of, I don't know what you call it, glamour there. A bit of front page notoriety here.
Yes.
Whichever way you want to look at it.
Yes. Yes. The clippings, I was looking over them again the other day, so I'm really terribly funny.
Well, what exactly did you do?
I had a lunch, and then lunch, and then there must have been 250 people at this lunch. They're very history conscious there, or they were in Perth. And, I had to make a speech. Well, I'd not made a speech in my life, of course, in those days. And I don't know what I said. I don't suppose I said anything, really. But it was all right, and they were very kind and nice, and hundreds of them lined up to come shake my hand afterwards. And then they took me out to Woodbridge, which is the place where old Uncle James had lived, and showed me around and so on, and they're very, very kind to me. And that was it.
Yeah, for sure. It was quite a change from being...
I was the junior midshipman because in those days, Dominion naval officers were equal with the junior two equivalent ranks Royal Naval officers, no matter.
I see.
No matter what.
No matter what your seniority was.
Seniority.
Yeah.
If I had a more seniority, but you see, all the junior midshipmen were exactly the same date.
I see.
1st September 1934. so that I was lost on Tim and Charlie.
Charlie, what you used the term doggy and tanky. What is the background of those?
Derivation of it?
Yeah.
Well, doggy, I think, is exactly what it sounds like. The doggy follows his master around and does things for him.
Mm-hmm.
He runs messages. If the commander turned to me and said, tell the chief to stop making that bloody smoke, I would go to the chief engineer and say, with the commander's compliments, so would it be possible to make less smoke? I learned this pretty fast, too. You're polite. You translate.
Didn't repeat what was told you exactly.
No. Like a good secretary.
Yes.
Or an aide-de-camp or something like that. He takes his master's wish and translates it into words which might be acceptable to the recipient.
Right.
And the tanky is a derivation of the fact that in ancient times and now, too, up until then anyway, the navigator was responsible for the state of the fresh water supply on the ship.
Ah.
And so his winger was the fellow who went and sounded the tanks every day to see how much there was and whether it was good or bad and things like that. So the navigator's man, Friday, was called the tanky.
Oh, I see.
I never had the job from enough. I think that we tended rather in that ship to freeze the jobs because of the kind of existence that we were having. Normally you'd change every 3 months or so, or 6 months, but I think that we, if I remember correctly, because of this royal progression that we're taking part in, we tended to hold the job so that things wouldn't go wrong. And if somebody knew how to do his job, well then he'd let him go on doing it until after the royal business was over, and then you could change things around and revert to a more normal practice.
When you were in Australia, a part of the Australian squadron, what sort of serious training went on, or was it a good deal of ceremony, social, showing the flag sort of thing? Did you go beyond the bounds of Australia in these sort of missions, or what? Did you exercise the squadron to any extent? What sort of?
We did mostly everything things in the squadron. As everywhere else, after a period in harbor or refit or boiler clean or what have you, you would want to go out and work up again. So we'd go, Sydney was our base. We'd go down to Jarvis Bay to the south, which was a naval base, and where the Naval College had been, their Naval College. And we'd, while we were based there, we'd do gunnery exercises, torpedo exercises, seamanship exercises, every exercise you can think of, in the normal naval manner, as is done today. And then having done that, and the other ships having done that, we joined together with the other ships and operated as a squadron. Now, the squadron at the time consisted only of two cruisers, Canberra and Sussex. Canberra was the flagship. And incidentally, they had an RN admiral and an RN captain, and the rest of the officers and men were Australian. It was a rather strange division. I don't know why that was, because the Australians must have been able to produce a captain by then.
That carried on for some time in the Australian Navy, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I never understood why.
Yeah, they weren't quite as adamant about it as we were.
And I think it was very foolish of them, too, because it made the would-be captains of their big ships very unhappy. Why can't I have that job? Why have I got to have what do they call commie bastards?
Yeah.
Commie bastards, yeah.
Yeah.
Why do they have to take plum jobs?
Yeah.
Well, of course, later on it worked out all right, and they did, and they do now, produce their own flag officers and captains and so on. And then we also did have some destroyers. Now, how many were there? Four. Ancient Vs of the V&W class of World War I. And the leader was Stuart, I think. But again, Captain D was an RN captain. I've forgotten his name now. But the captains of the individual destroyers, lieutenant commanders, two lieutenant commanders and one commander, I guess, were Australian. So there was a hierarchy building up there in the correct. Now, but then, we didn't do an awful lot of flag waving and so on. We did go up to Brisbane as a squadron for some jamboree in Brisbane, which I don't remember what. And apart from that and our exercises together, we didn't do an awful lot of cruising. We didn't go back to Melbourne again in my time. We did go back to Hobart and Tasmania, but we didn't go to any of the other state capitals apart from the ones I just mentioned. Sussex did go over to New Zealand in 35, but that, I suspect, was an RN caper, because at that time the New Zealand division, as it was called, was RN. It had New Zealand officers and men, but it was run and operated by the Royal Navy, with officers on loan to the New Zealand government, based in Wellington, in their Navy office. But we went. We started north of the North Island in the Bay of Islands, and make it work our way south and then around the bottom and over to Hobart. But that was in 35, I should think.
Well, so you completed your year of in Australia, and what happened then? Where did you go at the end of this period?
Oh, well, we were up in the Solomon Islands doing a flag wave, I suppose, and we were just about to go to the New Hebrides when the Abyssinian War broke out. And you remember that there was a great hoo-ha in the League of Nations, and would the League of Nations apply sanctions to Italy, and would they not, or would Britain blockade Italy, or Ethiopia, or anything, or what? And while all this was going on in Geneva, we were sitting in Tulagi, wondering quite what to do next. And we sailed from Tulagi on our way to the New Hebrides, and then decided that that was the wrong thing to do and turned back again. And dropped our hook in Tulagi once more, only to be told to go to Darwin. So we up anchor and went off to Darwin. The idea of that was that there was an old Itai cruiser messing about in the East Indies. And we were to cover her off if she started getting stroppy. But then this monstrous great cruiser would take her out.
Mm-hmm.
Which would have been no problem to us either. She had 6-inch guns, I think. She was very old. We had 8-inch guns, and we weren't very old. And as I said before, our gunnery had improved immensely since our Royal days. And I should think it would have been a 10-minute battle, because we could have sunk her outside her gun range. So, if it had come to it. But anyway, we sat in Darwin for, I think it was about a week, 10 days. And Darwin at that time looked like a Wild West town out of a Wild West movie. It was just a dirt street with a few shacks along each side. Mostly manned by Chinamen, actually.
Yeah. Not exactly the sort of town that the ship's company would enjoy.
Oh, it was miserable.
Yeah.
And hot.
Hot, yeah.
Boy, it was hot. Because this was summertime. Well, early fall, must be about September, I suppose. August, September. And then, I don't know, the Admiralty decided eventually what we were to do was to go back and join our squadron, the 1st CS, in the Med. So off we went.
Well, before you said, it seemed to me that the East Indies and the Solomons must have been amazingly peaceful sort of place in those days. I suppose not too many, not too much activity seaborne, except for small vessels. I
no,
guess.
No, it was
very
basic.
Yeah.
The part of the colonial empire, of course, and the operated by a resident. I remember sitting on the lawn of the residency in Tulagi and looking across at Guadalcanal, which came rather famous later.
Yeah.
And the wife of the resident telling me that there wasn't anybody there except headhunters, and all the people there were headhunters, and it was only a mile or two away, it seemed to me, in my recollection, but certainly very close, and all you could see was a forest.
Yeah.
We did get off in a skiff and went to another of the little islands nearby, which was entirely native, and poked around in the village, and this was quite interesting, because they were, the natives were utterly basic, and they were absolutely basic. They were natural, natural though.
Yeah.
And, peaceful would be the word, you bet.
Yeah.
No civilization at all. And the poor resident and his wife particularly were just delighted to see. yes, because I hadn't seen anybody for 6 months or something like that. Except trading schooner, which came around once in a while.
There was no staff there of any sort, no administration of any sort.
No, I think probably the president had a... I think there might have been one other white man. I don't even remember that very well. Mm.
Oh, you must have been a boon.
Yeah.
So, anyway, you left and went to the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose things were pretty alert there, too, because of the Italian and Ethiopian situation.
Well, yes, it was. I'm going through the canal along the way. We were on Port Said coming through. Italian troop ships were going down, and we just had to watch them go by, mm-hmm. which was aggravating. And the hospital ship came back.
It wasn't so aggravating.
No, we only stayed there for 24 hours, and we were afraid we were going to be kept the Valiant, the battleship Valiant, was the guard ship there. And we thought that was a good place for her, and we went on to Alex.
It must have been tremendously hot there, too, I suppose.
The side was awful, because there's no breeze there, and you just baked, and the battleship was even worse than we were. We were built for the tropics, and I don't know if you know that the county-class cruisers had very high deckheads. And the reason for it was that they were built after the First War as anti-commerce raiders. Was the idea that they would cruise in the tropical waters in case such people as Count von Luckner were to come out again in a war.
That's interesting. I've seen pictures of them, and they all seem to have very high freeboarding.
That's why.
That's why, because the decks were... Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the reason.
And consequently, in the tropics, they were more comfortable than most.
Yeah.
They had great big scuttles. Most scuttles are rather small, but these had great big ones for the same reason. Yet, when you could open them, you got some air in.
I suppose the fan exhaust system was always more efficient than probably...
It probably was, although it was still pretty basic.
Really
we never got to air conditioning in those days as we do nowadays, of course.
The engine was not been real.
The engine was worse, yes. The boiler room was never, you'd think it would be, but it didn't. The boiler room was cooler than the engine room because of the forced draft. Air blowing into the furnaces.
Of course, you've got to keep the pressure.
But in the engine room, there's nothing like that going on except there's the heat building up. You had got occasional cases of heat prostration in those cases, but they had, they drank a tremendous amount of barley water with a certain amount of salt in it. Salt tablets were required in the engine room. They had to take them.
Yeah.
And this was still going on, well after the war.
It seems to have gone out of favor a bit, this off the subject,
They had to take them.
Yeah.
And this was still going on, well after the war.
It seems to have gone out of favor a bit, this off the subject, salt tablets.
Salt tablets?
Yeah.
Yeah. They now think it has mad effects.
Yeah.
I couldn't take them. I don't know. Only one time I remember taking them, they made me vomit. And after that, I gave up. And
a little extra salt in the food, maybe. How were your supplies, speaking of that, in these very hot climates, how were your supplies of fresh food and this sort of thing? The ships of that nature have sufficient refrigeration to keep you going for a reasonable time? Long time?
I guess the cold rooms must have been fairly efficient, because I don't remember bad food ever being served.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in harbor, of course, your messman and the officer's mess is when you're on board special things.
Yeah, you got fresh food.
And the troops' food was considered something less than glamorous, I would say. It was pretty basic. I don't remember anything bad coming to my attention, at any rate. But probably I wouldn't have been told if it had, unless I'd happened to be on the spot when the complaint was made, which is unlikely. I'd have to be on watch. They didn't make ice. You never had ice drinks, even in the tropics. You know, gin and water which is almost body temperature.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary. Well, as you know, the English don't like ice in their drinks anyway half the time. Certainly didn't in the Royal Navy. They didn't have it. Unheard of. And they didn't have little fridges with ice trays in like you do. So, I think basically the supply system must have been extremely good to supply.
Well, one would think so, but it's a question that one would...
It's a thought I haven't occurred to me for some time. But, you see, Alexandria Harbor was full. There's a whole Mediterranean fleet and some of the Atlantic fleet there. So the supply organization must have been extremely efficient.
Indeed.
Must have been.
Yeah.
They hardly ever left. And if one ship were left, another one came in. It's sort of a hot berth principle almost. Because we had to be. There was great excitement there one day. An Italian liner came in. She was still allowed to do that. And as she came through the very narrow passage into the harbor, she exploded. Everybody said, aha, box ship. And so she was whistled through the hole, great speed. And she did sink, but she sank inside the harbor. They'd managed to get her onto a bit of a sandbank.
Boiler explosion or something?
Yeah.
Was it? That's very
and
funny.
I never did hear it was sabotage, but it was just too pat not to have been, I think.
Yeah.
And if they'd succeeded, they'd have had the whole fleet bottled in there. And the laughing stock of the whole world.
Indeed, yeah.
Oh, boy. But it didn't work, anyway.
Yeah.
And it fell to my lot as a midshipman of a boat to take one of these fellows to a shore, to a hospital. And, I don't know, this made me feel part of the action. I didn't do anything except take him in the motorboat and put him on the... Well, we had to wait for the ambulance, and I gave him a cigarette and cocks to my boat. So it was a very dark view of that. He didn't think I was decent. We'd give Itize a cigarette.
Yeah.
And besides, you weren't allowed to smoke in the boat. So I told him to shut up. He said he wouldn't.
Oh,
it was an awful scene.
Oh, dear.
But, however, it blew over. But it made me feel part of it, anyway.
Yes, right. What did you do when you were in Alexandria? Anything?
Well, just rush out and fire off guns and exercises and maneuvers and so on and so on. We were always exercising.
And this is coming towards the end of your midshipman tour, then, was it?
Yes. Things are almost. Well, then from there, that thing sort of simmered down a bit. And then Sussex was sent to Haifa, where we the Palestine business was just starting up nicely. And we ran an armored train up to Samark, and we had a pom-pom mounted on a lorry up near Nablus. And we helped man minesweepers, which were patrolling up and down the coast, trying to catch illegal immigrants and so on.
Well, this armored train, now, who produced that for you to man? Or did you build it?
Well, no, the Palestine government produced the rolling stock, and we converted it. Shipwrights turned it into a thing, mounted guns on it.
Plate on it and put some guns. What sort of guns did you...
I think they were pom-poms, from the ship.
Uh-huh.
Oh, no, they were they weren't from the ship, they were supplied.
Ah.
But they were ship type.
Presumably single barrel pom-poms,
were they? Yes.
I should imagine.
Yes, I think they were.
You know, quite a lot of recoil if you had the multiple barrels.
Yes, you would have. No, it must be
for a railway car, I would say.
Yeah. And a searchlight on the other end.
Oh, yeah.
There was an engine with a searchlight track one way and... gun and the other. And produced a run up in the morning and run down again at dawn to keep make sure the track was clear for the mail train that was coming through. It came through sort of soon after dawn.
pretty primitive when you think of what happened to the railway rolling stock in the Second World War.
Well, we were fighting a primitive foe.
Yes,
They thought it was, they allowed us out to one of our people who went into a cafe in the souk in Haifa. But it is distinctly unsporting of us to do this. And particularly the pom-pom lorry up in the blue said it was definitely offside.
Mm-hmm.
Not fair.
Not fair.
Not fair
at all.
Not fair, no.
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 And the souk, that was the native quarter.
Yeah.
Haifa, Arab quarter.
Yes.
Well, there's a little bit of, even in the early stages of sort of a guerrilla war, there was a certain amount of rules and...
Well,
they
were still thinking of, in the past, you know, well, warfare was an honorable thing. And
yes.
You played according to certain rules.
Yes.
Well, they didn't have pom-poms, so why should we have pom-poms?
Right.
You see?
Yes.
And if you look at it in that light, well, you can see their attitude.
Yes, right.
Didn't make any sense to us, but it did to them. What it did to that individual,
well,
anyway.
Well, certainly, yeah.
Interesting. Whether he was a man of rank or... stature and his I don't know. History doesn't really.
No.
It was an interesting time.
Yes, indeed. Were you actually part of the crew of one of these?
Of the train, yeah.
Were you?
Mm-hmm. Well, never shot at, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Actually, the train was only shot at once, and it wasn't on my watch. And they did, I think they buttoned the bad shoot up anyway.
Just a train crew? Did you have enough seamen aboard, or Marines, to make a foray if necessary? Or what was the,
That was strictly against the rules.
Yeah.
All we were there for was to protect the railway line. And we did have a little gas car that went ahead in case of obstructions.
Yes.
And indeed, one night there was an obstruction, came around a bend and there were a bunch of rocks on the rail. So the gas car was derailed, but it stopped the train in time. And then, of course, that was the time they were shot at. It was a little bit of an ambush, but it didn't work very well. And they pulled the rocks off the line and put the gas car back on it and went on.
We went.
And the train that we were supposed to protect was coming down later. Now, it came through without any hitch.
No, it was just one train a day, so
I guess so.
Yeah.
I guess so. I may have been a later one, but that was the important one. And that's this train went on down to Mecca eventually. So it was a pretty important one.
And how long did you how long were you there doing this? Oh,
3 months,
mm-hmm.
2 months. We did our seamanship exam there, and we were much busier sort of fighting an incipient war than studying. You know, however, it worked all right. We all passed at least. And then we went to Spanish Neutrality Patrol of Spain.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
For incidentally, there's a sidelight in this, which is of interest, I think. The Canadian government had lost track of me.
Oh, really?
Or else I wouldn't have been there for these exciting things. Because at that time, if you recall, 36, 37, the Canadian government was even more isolationist than it had ever been before.
Yes, they were very isolated.
And some of my colleagues, some people were whipped out of the men because they were in a war zone or a near war zone.
No involvement at all.
Exactly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I understand that some people were, I don't know for sure some people were removed, but we heard that they had been. And I, and luckily my captain, agreed that we should keep awful quiet about me, because here was an opportunity for me to take part in fun and games and so on, and the things that naval officers are supposed to be capable of doing, which if I suddenly went back to Canada, I wouldn't be able to do.
Yes, right.
And so I didn't, I stayed. And the Neutrality Patrol is another case in point. I'm sure that Mackenzie King wouldn't have cared for that a bit.
No, I don't think he would have.
Mm.
Oh, dear. So what, you left Haifa and went, where were you based?
In Haifa.
Neutrality
Patrol. Well, Jib, I suppose.
Yeah.
We'd go out and cruise around, and then we'd anchor in Tangier for a bit. And the German pocket battleship Deutschland came in one time while we were there, and an ISAR cruiser, whose name I forget. She was a pretty ship too. She came in. Then we go off and patrol again, and of course they were intervening like crazy on their side, on Franco's side, and we were supposed to be preventing such things. Well, we wouldn't have stood much of a chance against Deutschland had it come to a shooting.
Yeah. You patrolled up towards the Balearic Islands?
Mallorca
or somewhere?
Yeah. The men from this far. We did one, as I recall, up the Atlantic coast, too. But then it was somebody else's sector north of Portugal, and we only went up to Cadiz or a bit beyond, I suppose.
Well, what did you do?
Nothing.
You simply cruised up and down.
A peasant. I think we were in their presence. I don't think we had anything to do.
No.
I don't know.
No. Well, you couldn't, I suppose it was very difficult to stop any sort of vessels in the high seas.
We're dependent on how tight our blockade was, Britain's blockade was, or what the declaration was, and I can't remember.
Yeah.
I don't think it declared a blockade as such.
I don't think it was that tight, no.
Although somewhere up beyond Barcelona, I think there were instances of stopping ships being stopped, I should say. And there were up on the Biscay coast, too.
Wasn't there an Italian cruiser that was sunk up there by the the government forces?
I don't remember.
It struck me there was some war vessel was...
Well, the Spanish cruiser was pasted in Algeciras Bay, right off Gibraltar,
yeah.
By the other side. I can't remember which side she was on. Who did the
pasting? Were you there?
No.
See it? Oh.
No. No, it had happened just before we arrived, I think. Jaime was her name. I don't remember which side she was on. Sure, maybe she was sunk. I don't remember.
Yeah. So, in effect, you didn't really do, there wasn't any sort of stop and search operation carried on.
No, not by us.
Sort. And, you must have wondered to some extent what the hell you were doing there, really.
It really, because, news is intermittent. When we got into port, we get our mail and newspapers back 6 weeks, so we had to try and find out what was going on. Though I didn't have radio broadcasts all the time. It didn't happen. So, how we knew what was going on at all, I don't know. I don't remember.
There's certainly the potential for some excitement, even if it didn't.
Yes. That is exciting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sort of on tenterhooks.
Yeah. Well, I see time marches on, Mickey, and so that we'll continue this next week if that's satisfactory to you. Okay? And thanks very much for coming this morning. We'll be moving to a new office, and we'll organize that before you leave, right?